I want to talk about the heart, the essence of Christmas. It's a holiday laden with myth. All holidays are laden with myth, but few quite so clearly as Christmas. Now, Unitarians love Christmas. It is my observation, it's our favorite holiday. But this was not always so. As I explained last year, our Puritan ancestors deplored this day, as it had no clear scriptural basis. True enough, the nativity narratives in Luke and Matthew say the baby Jesus was born in a stable in Bethlehem, that shepherds, beckoned by an angel, were in attendance, and that later, on Epiphany, Twelfth Night, wise men came from the east seeking to see him. But these narratives are full of anomalies. To cite only the most obvious, why would shepherds be out in the wintertime in the first place? They wouldn't be, period. The Puritans were all well-versed in Scripture and very serious in their daily readings and devotionals. They knew these anomalies, and they knew, too, of the Roman holiday of Saturnalia, an annual return of the sun ritual that Roman authorities grafted into Christianity in order to make the new religion more palatable to their fourth century subjects. So for the Puritans, Christmas was pagan, pure and simple, and they wanted nothing to do with it. Indeed, from 1659 to 1681, celebrating Christmas was illegal in Massachusetts. People caught with an Advent wreath were subject to punishment and a fine. There were apparently secret celebrations, or they would not have made such laws. But as the Puritans themselves were in periodic trouble with authorities back in London, there were occasions when their rule was less secure and ergo less severe. And on such occasions, the popular social order, part of a cultural world that went back millennia, sort of bubbled up. Christmas was an important and symbolically charged part of that cultural upwelling. By the 1730s and there ever after, religious authorities more or less stopped condemning Christmas and began instead to purify it of its seasonal excesses. This goes on to this day. Those who would put Christ back in Christmas are but modern-day Puritans. After 1760, it became unusual not to celebrate Christmas, and no hymnal published thereafter failed to include a Christmas hymn. Our current hymnal, this one, Singing the Living Tradition, has 33 hymns, kind of bowderized, about half of them, but well-known and familiar, and more than in any other category in our hymnal. So when I say it's our favorite, just look at the empirical evidence. In the popular imagination, myths equal primitive untruths. In fact, myths are neither primitive nor untrue. They are rather a kind of poetry or imagery that helps us make sense of the world and of our place in it. They are not to be taken literally, any more than Shakespeare or Mark Twain or Emily Dickinson. They should, however, be taken seriously. The philosopher Alan Watts, who spoke to several of our churches and fellowships back in the 1960s, defined myth as an imagery with which we make sense of the world. In any case, people who reject myth out of hand, it seems to me, are as confused about its intention as those who take it literally. The key, if you want to understand myth, is one, to enjoy it as poetry, and two, strip away the hokum by demythologizing it, by Well, what are the roots? What are these symbols and fantastica all about? If you strip away the myth and see it as myth, as metaphor and poetry, that is, then you can enjoy it all the more and see its value and meaning all the more clearly. And you're not hung up on having to take these things literally, divine birth, you know, blah, blah. And just, it's like that first hymn we say, when Christ is born, when you have a pure thought, that's the rebirth of the baby Jesus in your heart. It's not about some manger in suburban Bethlehem. So what is the Christmas myth? Basically, it seems to me it's about faith and hope and renewal. And also, Christmas is about the means to nurture these needed qualities, faith, hope, renewal, in our communities and in each of our hearts and in our families. People everywhere celebrate the cycle of nature. All the northern hemisphere cultures celebrate winter solstice, as we will, as Luann Strubel, if her appendix is fully healed, she and Chris will lead here on the 21st. But people everywhere in the northern hemisphere celebrate the winter solstice, when the days stop getting shorter and the sun begins its six-month return of increasingly longer and longer days. Christmas is one of these festivals. Hanukkah is another. In India, it's called Sankranti. In China, it's known as Dongzi. The Hopi Indians of Arizona have Soyal, a month-long celebration with rituals to ensure victory of light over darkness. Hopi culture is deeply entwined with aiding the sun's return and giving strength to budding life. So it's not surprising that Soyal lasts for 20 days and includes prayer, stick making, purification, rituals, and a concluding rabbit hunt, feast, and blessing. Other Indian tribes have similar rites. There seems to be something innately human and healing in the keeping of holidays and in the celebration of seasonal turning points. The 20th century English author G.K. Chesterton observed, "We tend to tire of the most eternal splendors, and a mark on the calendar or a crash of bells at midnight maybe reminds us that we have only recently arrived on this planet." So we create ritual observances, celebrations, and festivals, and thereby add enough of the human touch to cosmic events to make us stop and pay attention to the great natural drama that unfolds before our eyes every single day. The practice of bringing greenery indoors and festooning our homes with the few plants that retain their color through winter, pine trees, ivy, holly, mistletoe. This is pretty universal, too. The Puritans, of course, sought to prevent this, but to no avail. People are part of nature, and they want to be around it and have it around them. Nature heals and connects us to life and to a sense of being alive. This was Ralph Waldo Emerson's and the Transcendentalists' greatest insight, that the closest we can get to God is in the direct, unmediated experience of nature. And that doing so is healing and good for the soul. Not only are we part of nature, it is part of us. We belong to it. It flows through us in the arts and sciences, to be sure, but also in cultural folkways and idioms. Completely demythologized, Christmas is about having faith that the sun, S-U-N, will return, and hope that even in the darkest of times, light will come again, and warmth, and a regenerated earth. The custom of decorating our Christmas tree with fruits and flowers and ornaments that look like them reveals the natural cycle of life at the heart of our celebrations, whether we think about it or not. And this, as much as anything else, is what's so amazing about the natural cycle of life. It goes on whether we pause to contemplate it or not, and us along with it. Nature will heal us, whether we are in touch with it or not in touch with it. Spring, with real fruits and flowers, will come along whether or not we decorate a tree. Nature will do this all by itself and carry us along in the process. Life continues and new life will come in its many forms. The days will grow longer. The earth will renew itself. Babies will be born, and some of whom, though born in extremely modest circumstances, will grow up to do great, even prophetic things. Love happens, and people are renewed and strengthened in the process every day. When we understand myth as poetry, we realize that all parts of the story are happening all the time. Tyrants are trying to kill newborns or cage them away. People are living in very modest circumstances. There's all these parts of the Christian story are right there all the time. Nevertheless, the Christian myth focuses on one particular winter, roughly 2,000 years ago, when Jesus of Nazareth, a man later executed by Roman authorities, was allegedly born. The nativity narratives that we're all familiar with essentially reflect the efforts of early Christian mythmakers to conflate the natural cycle of the returning S-U-N son with the birth of one particular S-O-N son. They wanted Jesus to be born in Bethlehem so that he'd be, through Joseph, whom they rendered more or less a kind of stepfather, in the lineage of King David. The mythmakers also put wise men, which I always think of as professors, scientists, pundits of the day, and shepherds, hardworking stiffs, you know, out punching their clocks, in attendance, and raging tyrants out to get the baby, to get all that which would threaten them. And all this, we might, and by virtue of all this, we might recognize this particular birth's importance. But what made it so important? Here's what I think. Jesus' birth was important because his message as an adult was the human counterpart to the natural cycle of earth and sun, a recipe for renewal in our social and domestic and political relationships. And that message? Love. It's actually a pretty tough message to even hear sometimes, let alone follow. The prophet Jesus, when he grew up, preached radical love and inclusiveness. There were those who did not like that message, and they had him put to death. And there are those today who would pervert his message by twisting it into selective love and exclusivity. Like the evangelical Reverend Ted Haggard, since brought down by scandal, who only a year before his downfall had consigned to a hell of everlasting torment interviewer Barbara Walters, a Jew, and all others like her who did not buy into his narrow, restrictive views of what is right. By any calculus, this is mean-spirited, or as one commentator said at the time, Ted Haggard believes in a hell of a God and preaches, he's still at it, a message very different from that of the actual Jesus, whose mythic birthday we celebrate in 18 days. The harder they come sometimes, the harder they fall. Ted seems to be softening a little bit and become more self-reflective of late, having written that he now believes evangelical Christianity has abandoned the actual gospel for, quote, image management and damage control. Maybe, he goes on, we should be willing to admit that we are all growing in grace, be willing to be numbered with the transgressors, and never overstating or overpromising. He said that, and then about the next paragraph, he went right back into his regular spiel. Love your enemies, turn the other cheek when assailed, and pray for those who persecute you. In case you hadn't noticed, this is not the message that the Ted Haggard of old or other fundamentalists put forth. Like the most rigid Puritans, like King Herod, like Ted Haggard in his younger days and his still rigid fundamentalist allies, such people are cut off from the natural wellsprings of renewal and would have us cut off too. Loving your enemy, turning the other cheek when assailed, and praying for those who persecute you. Cynics and self-described realists will decry such ideas as wimpish sentimentality and always have. We just saw the movie Where's My Roy Cohn, and in it Roger Stone, recently convicted, shows how it was that hypercombative attorney Ray Kong, his mentor, instructed him and a friend of his, the current chief executive, to never apologize under any circumstances for anything you've done. A far cry from Jesus' message. In just the same way that lighting candles and decorating trees helps boost our spirits in the midst of winter, learning to love and celebrating the love we are already graced to receive and to share can bring hope and faith even in the darkest times, despite what Roy Cohn and Roger Stone may think. The late C.S. Lewis was a prolific author. One of his books, The Great Divorce, has always stayed with me. In it, Lewis finds himself on a strange bus ride to, is it heaven? The passengers eventually disembark on a broad plain leading to a mountain range off in the distance, a place not unlike the Santa Fe Basin in New Mexico, where I used to live, with the Sangre de Cristo Mountains rising to the east. As the passengers look out over the beautiful expanse, they spy, coming to meet them, spirit guides who will lead them over the mountain. But heavens, it turns out in every case, the guide is the one person that the guests do not want to meet. The former spouse who ran off with somebody else, the business partner who defrauded them, and so on. If getting into heaven means having to be escorted by you, then I will make my habitations elsewhere, thank you. And so nearly all of them get back on the bus and go home. People would rather live in hell or purgatory, Lewis's imagery clearly suggests, if living in heaven requires letting go of their familiar resentments and forgiving one another. This is sad, it seems to me, but all too often very true. Learning to love is never easy. It means letting go of a lot of things that don't really matter so much. Now, loving a little child, for most of us, is easy. I mean, I was just with my 6-year-old grandson and my 4-year-old granddaughter, and, well, the grandson's kind of a handful, but the granddaughter is very easy to love. They're both lovely kids, and they're totally vulnerable and dependent, and so our natural maternal and paternal instincts take over. We incline naturally to want to love children and make sure that they are safe and comfortable, and we're willing to keep at bay whatever calamities lay outside our domestic perimeter, that this baby might sleep peacefully through the night and rise up, eager, filled with hopeful expectation. It's harder to love the less innocent. People who are grown up, and especially those who make choices that hurt us or others whom we love, sometimes knowing they're hurting us, but who do it anyway. This is why family members and friends so easily hurt us, and why we sometimes steel ourselves against them, even when we don't consciously intend it. Nevertheless, maintained the grown-up Jesus, love and forgiveness and reaching out is the way to renewal, to the return of warmth and light in human relationships. Another thing, Jesus's message of solidarity with the dispossessed and nonviolence in the face of violence also resonates with nature. and with the natural cycle of life. His message is the human social overlay and complement to the life cycle, that love is the human way to get through the winter and begin the spring. The winter of December, January, and February, and the winter we create in our own lives and hearts whenever we give up hope in one another and cast our lot with the centurion guard, that is, with whoever's playing the role of King Herod and his mercenary legions in our own time and place, whatever the era. In the face of darkness, the human capacity to love is our hope. Reaching out in love will generate faith as surely as spring follows winter. This is the demythologized heart of Christmas and of all the other solstice celebrations. Nonviolent inclusivity will come to flower and bear fruit if only we're hopeful and faithful enough to see it through. As Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, modern day incarnations of this same message, made clear, by virtue of their incredible success despite dark forces aligned against them. Healing, wrote the poet W.H. Auden, is not a science, but the intuitive act of wooing nature. Nature restores us by reminding us of our connections to the earth and to the natural life cycle. Solstice celebrations help us pause that we might remember our mortality, how brief our span of years on earth, and take steps to live fully and lovingly while we can. I want to make one final point. The winter solstice marks the return of the sun, but only the beginning of winter. Once the days begin getting longer, the weather continues to be cold and damp for at least another 6 to 10 weeks. Striving to love one another will help us through the wet and blustery days ahead. But so will patience, the art of lying fallow, of aligning our biological clocks with that of the natural world and resting internally. In winter, the life energy is still underground. The return of the sun is just beginning. The movement underground is just as at its beginning, as is the movement within each of our souls. Therefore, it must be strengthened by rest. Again, the little Jesus is, you know, little babies do a lot of rest. And that's the natural thing at this time of year. Allowing energy that's renewing itself to be strengthened by rest means that it won't be dissipated and used prematurely or unskillfully. As with the return of health after an illness or the return of understanding after an estrangement, everything must be treated tenderly and with care at the beginning so that the return may lead to a flowering later on. This is what the image of Jesus in the manger is all about, it seems to me. Allowing ourselves to love, difficult as it may be, that the tender promise of renewal will come to flower and soon enough. So may it be. Amen. And may blessings abide.